I don't know how many of you are familiar with a song called Macarena. It's a prolific song that was quite popular in the 90s, viral, if you may. And it was a song that kind of happened with dance moves. Every time the song would come on, you know, strangers would gather together because of the familiarity with the song and knowing the dance moves and just kind of dance together. I really, really enjoyed that about the song. And in general, I mean, it was a good song, a good groove, a good vibe. So it was a likable enough song. This song, however, I realized a couple of years ago when I was at one of my children's sports days, that I actually didn't really know what the song was about. I was familiar with some of the language, right? Because some of it is in English, but the chorus is in Spanish and I didn't really know what it was saying. Anyway, suffice it to say, when the song came on that day at the sports day, everybody gathered together, even the little kids, to do the Macarena. And I thought to myself, I wonder what the song is actually really about. I thought the song was just about, you know, a cute girl dancing at a party, at a club, and just having a good time with her friends. But it turns out, as I Googled translation of the Macarena and ran into some super intriguing titles, that maybe it's not such an innocent song. Two of my favorite titles say this. It turns out the Macarena has some very dirty lyrics. Another favorite of mine says, people have worked out that the Macarena lyrics are not child friendly. So I looked up the lyrics and they're not child friendly. It suffices to say that Macarena, who is the main character in the song, just displays some questionable judgment when it comes to, well, my boyfriend is away and there are these guys who are showing interest in me. Let's see what happens. I'll leave that to your holy imagination. So what is my point? My point is this. There are sometimes strange lyrics in a song that we don't know what to do with, right? We hear the song, we're familiar with the song, but when we're hearing some of the lyrics, it doesn't get in the way of us enjoying the song until we look up the lyrics and realize that, I'm not sure this is what I want to be teaching to my 10-year-old daughter. Similarly, I want to say this. There are some scriptures that are super, super strange and probably very difficult to explain to a 10-year-old. And for today's word, we're going to be exploring some strange scriptures that, though they are strange, they are nestled in this very familiar narrative, the story of Noah and the flood. I'm sure most of us know this story and are quite familiar with it. Noah, knowing that there's a flood coming, kind of pairs up the animals and him and his family get into the ark. The flood happens, the flood subsides, and Noah saves the earth, or Noah saves creation, that is the animals and himself and his family. Simple enough, right? But when you look into the text, you come across some strange scriptures. And today I am hoping, unlike the Macarena, when we look into these scriptures, we won't find ourselves repelled, but we will find ourselves drawn in to the story of God as we are carrying on with our series, The Greatest Story Ever. So to land us in today's narrative found in Genesis 6 to 9, what I want to do is give us a backdrop against which this narrative is going to be taking place. And in order to do this, you guessed it, we have to go back right to the beginning. So in the beginning, we see God creating the heavens and the earth and everything in between. God creates, God orders from these wild, chaotic, formless waters, and he speaks. And in his speaking, he creates and he separates the heavens and the earth. When we think about the heavens and the earth and this creation narrative, what we need to consider is that what the author is trying to get us to see is that heaven and earth, or the heavens and the earth, are two different things, two separate entities, as it were, two different realities that are existing parallel to one another. Not only are they two different things, they're very different in nature. And when we read about how God continues to populate the heavens and the earth, our modern eye may not be able to pick up that in this populating, where God says he assigns the greater light to rule over the day and the lesser light to rule over the night, and he populates the skies with the stars, our modern eye would focus on the natural elements that are happening in the narrative. But the ancient Middle Eastern mind would understand that what's happening here is that God is populating the heavens with heavenly creatures in the same way that as he continues, he populates the earth with earthly creatures. These heavenly beings, these heavenly creatures that are spoken about in Genesis 1 and 2 are called by many different names in different parts of the scripture. These angels, these deities, that is, as it were, are sometimes called the host of heaven, or the heavenly host, the divine council, or sons of God. Sometimes they're called rulers and authorities. And they're even called signs in the sky. It's important to note, though, that even though the ancients, in their minds, when they think about these heavenly beings, they would think of them as gods, the author of the Bible is making it very clear that there is one God, and this one God created all creatures, both heavenly and earthly. So we find ourselves with these parallel realities that are separate but also have this potential of overlapping, and they are populated by this God, heavenly creatures in the heavenly space, which is arguably God's space, and earthly creatures here on earth, which is arguably the human's space. God orders. God sets boundaries. God gives authority, both in the heavens and the earth. Then we carry on with the story and we see God creating man and putting him into the garden of Eden. God makes man in his image and in his likeness. So, in the minds of the ancients, what would they be thinking in hearing this? For them, they would understand that the Garden of Eden is not just a garden. They would have seen that the Garden of Eden, though the whole earth is God's temple and filled with his presence, the Garden of Eden would be that space of overlap where the heavenly and the earthly kind of coexist. Meet. It's almost like the Garden of Eden would be the gateway to heaven, where heavenly creatures and earthly creatures occupy the same space in time, right? So, when the ancients look at motifs of gardens in their minds, when they see gardens or high mountain spaces being highlighted, especially where gods are present and walking about in the garden, and there's this communion with humanity or this fellowship with humanity, what would have sparked in their minds would be that God, that the Garden of Eden is a temple. The Garden of Eden would arguably be the place where the presence of God is most richly felt, the place where the presence of God rested, the place that would be the abode of God here on earth. And when the ancients see God taking this man, Adam, and putting him in the garden, in the temple, to work it, to look after it, to care for it, understanding that he is the image of God, they would have also seen that not only is he the image of God, but he is also a priest in the temple of God. Those words, to work it and to keep it, are very similar to the words that are used when the Levites are called to look after the tabernacle, when they're called into their priestly duties. So, Adam is the image of God. Adam is a priest, but we also see that Adam is a king. We see that God gives humanity, he gives Adam and Eve as priests and as a king and queen in his temple, in his creation, authority and a mandate to take dominion and subdue the earth. They are given royal reign, as it were, over the earth and called to move the reign of the King of Kings into all the earth. God calls them to rule his creation in his love. So, just like the stars in the sky in the minds of the ancients are not just stars, but heavenly creatures, just like the Garden of Eden is not just a garden, but it is a temple, a cosmic temple, where the presence of God is rich and humanity has unhindered access to God, we see another creature showing up in this narrative. Before we carry on and speak about the fall, if I had to ask you, why is the world broken? Why is the world in the state that it is? You may have a couple of different answers. And if you are Christian and you believe in the God of Jesus, you would say the reason that the world is the way that it is because of the fall, because Adam and Eve allied themselves with someone, which caused a fall. Not only their fall, but the fall of humanity and creation. In the ancients' mind, though, if you had to ask, why is the world the way that it is? Why is it broken and fallen? They would have a two-tiered answer. And in their minds, one of the answers would be the fall, but they would have a second answer. And their second answer would be this, that there was not only a rebellion on earth, but there was a rebellion in heaven. So now, enter this character in what we term the fall narrative. Adam and Eve are created sinless, but with a free will. Adam and Eve are created with bodies from the dust, bodies made of clay, but with full access to eternal life. Adam and Eve experience the full, unhindered joy and access of God's presence. And they were also naked and unashamed. Their conscience, in other words, was not seared. This creature then enters the garden, and the Bible describes him as a snake, this serpent-like creature. And I say that he is a serpent-like creature because I want you to consider that in the same way that the garden is not just a garden, the serpent is not just a serpent. The fact that the serpent talks gives it away that there is more happening here than what meets the eye. But besides that, remember, Eden is a high place where earth and its creatures overlap with heaven and its creatures. The serpent-like creature is clearly the first portrait of evil that we see in the Bible. He comes distorting what God has purposed for good and ruining and dragging creation back into darkness and disorder. Some theologians believe that it is possible that this snake was a seraphim, which is a heavenly creature. And this is because that word seraph means snake. And in some ancient literatures and ancient spaces, we see custodians of the throne of God or custodians or protectors of deities in heaven imaged as snakes with wings. This serpent-like creature comes and he tempts Adam and Eve, and they choose to do what God told them not to do and eat of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. Everything goes downhill from there. In their decision to believe the serpent and eat the fruit that they were prohibited from eating, they rebel and ally themselves with the original rebel. The consequence thereof is death. Adam and Eve, being born with bodies of clay, though not created to die in this moment because they choose to believe another, they lose access to the tree of life. Not only do they lose access to the tree of life, and probably more devastating than that, they lose access to the presence of God. Chaos, disruption, disorder begins again in this place. And the result was that humanity was going to live in a broken world. This serpent figure that we spoke about becomes Lord of the dead in the Israelite thinking, because from this point on, everything dies. This is contrary to what God had purposed. So we continue with the story, moving from Genesis 1, 2, and 3, all the way through 4 and 5, until we arrive at 6. In Genesis 5, there are 10 generations from Adam to Noah, with some descendants living well into their 900s. And when we enter Genesis 6, we are to understand that over these centuries, the story of humanity has gotten progressively worse. From Adam and Eve disobeying God to, in the next generation, Cain murdering his brother, the downward spiral can be assumed to be a terrible trajectory. Now, it came about when mankind began to multiply in the face of the land and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw that the daughters of mankind were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not remain with man forever, because he is also flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. Verse 4, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of mankind, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of mankind was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. So the Lord was sorry that he had made mankind on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. Verse 11, now the earth was corrupt in the sight of God, and the earth was filled with violence. And God looked on the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for humanity had corrupted its way upon the earth. Now, these passages are infamously controversial and difficult to interpret. So even as we journey into them, I want us to journey with humility and circumspectness. The one thing that I want us to be sure about, however, concerning these scriptures, is that in the Jewish mind, they understood that they described the reason that depravity and wickedness was propagated and accelerated in the earth. So, the sons of God, who are they? The Nephilim, who are they, and how are they connected to the increase of corruption and evil? There are a couple of interpretations as to who the sons of God are. One interpretation says they are the line of Seth, the godly line of Seth, while the daughters of man come from the ungodly line or the rebellious line of Cain, and that their marrying together grieved God. The interpretation that I hold, which I believe is the correct interpretation, in that it preserves the original context of the ancient Middle East, is that these sons of God were indeed heavenly creatures. These sons of God were these creatures that we were introduced to in Genesis 1 and 2 in the creation narrative. These particular sons of God that are described here represent the heavenly creatures that rebelled against God's order. They violate the boundaries of God and take for themselves human wives. The word wives there is not speaking to marriage, but rather to intercourse. Along with that, they take their heavenly knowledge and use it to further corrupt the humans, teaching humanity to destroy themselves. They taught them skills and technologies for warfare and awful inhumane acts of how to warfare. They taught them astrology and how to intoxicate themselves and enter altered states using herbs and plants. They taught them arts of seduction to increase immorality. What they taught the humans accelerated depravity and turned their hearts, this is the humans' hearts, to idolatry. They gave humans the opportunity to destroy themselves more efficiently. What then are the Nephilim? The Nephilim are the offspring of this disordered relation. These Nephilim were not a new idea in the minds of the ancient. For them, because of the way that they saw the world, because of the framework with which they lived, because of how they understood the earthly and the heavenly, and how those spaces interact and how those creatures interact, this for them was not a far-fetched idea. I know for us, when we think of divine beings or heavenly beings lying with earthly creatures, we do not have a category for that. But in the ancient minds, this was something that was pervasive. They had a holding place for what I just described. So these Nephilim were giants. They were violent, debaucherous, bloodthirsty offspring, half man, half god, who were also called the heroes of old or men of renown. Some ancient cultures actually believed that they were founded and ruled by these men of renown. So The story goes that as God looked upon the unspeakable corruption and violence that had filled the earth, he decides to send a flood to wipe out the human race and all the creatures on the earth. So, where did this flood happen? The whole story of Noah and the flood is told such that we are to understand that it happened in Mesopotamia. This great flood occurs in the floodplain that lies between the Euphrates and the Tigris. This part of the world is infamous for flooding, and there are archaeological records that show that that place, that floodplain, experienced multiple floods, and that these floods were known to have wiped out whole civilizations. Though the text uses universal words like God covering all the earth with the flood, what we're meant to understand is that the ancient Near Eastern mind, to the ancient Near Eastern mind, this was their world. So that speaks to where the flood happened. When did this flood happen? Theologians deduce that this flood happened at what we call the dawn of human civilization. This flood narrative is found in many ancient cultures, the Babylonian cultures, the Sumerian culture, and in ancient Jewish culture. And in all these cultures, it is described as a history-marking event. So, that is to say, life before the flood is dramatically different from life after the flood. And this is clear in all the literature of these different surrounding cultures. One of these markers of difference in all these cultures is that we see the lifespan of humans dramatically dropping. Now, it is important to note that the authors of the text are not trying to prove that this flood happened to their listeners. Their assumption is that everyone knew of this great flood, and it was not up for dispute in their minds. But what they're trying to do is to give their listeners an interpretation of the flood. So there was one popular flood narrative that happened in Mesopotamia, where the gods have had enough with humanity. They are making too much noise, disturbing their sleep. They're just too difficult to control. So what the gods decide is that what they're going to do is send a flood to wipe out the human race. One of these gods, however, goes rogue, and he is grieved and doesn't want humanity to die. So he goes and he finds a Noah-like a human whom he strategized with, and they decide to build an ark. And this ark, much like the Noah narrative, saves this human and his family, or this man and his family. When the waters subside, this deity says then to this man, you know what, I think you should have a sacrifice, right? Stage a sacrifice. And as this man does this sacrificial offering and the aroma rises up to the gods are like, were we crazy? Were we crazy thinking of getting rid of these humans? They feed us. How could we get rid of them? So instead, they find an alternative way to control the humans, i.e. have a functioning slave race, and they introduce famine, plagues, and warfare. Now, the biblical interpretation is very different from this. The biblical writers, in narrating the story and interpreting it, what they are doing is that they're making a theological claim about God. Their interpretation is very countercultural. And as Michael Heiser says, their interpretation is undermining the Mesopotamian gods and other aspects of the culture's worldview. The biblical authors interpret the event as God cleansing the planet and starting again. Genesis 7:11 says this, on that day, all the springs of the great deep burst forth, and the floodgates of the heavens were opened, and rain fell on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. So just like Eden is not just a garden, but a cosmic temple, and the humans are not just creatures, but image bearers who are a royal priesthood in God's earthly temple. And the serpent is not just a talking snake, but a crafty heavenly creature. The flood is not just a flood. If you remember the creation story, God ordered the heavens and the earth from the chaotic, formless, desolate emptiness that was the dark, deep waters. By his spirit, by his ruach, he brings order and life. What we see in the flood narrative is the chaotic waters being given free rein again to be sovereign over the earth. This narrative, according to the biblical writers, is a decreation narrative. I imagine it as God removing his life-giving spirit and his order, which is currently the only thing that is holding everything together. And he allows creation to descend back into that watery, formless, lifeless darkness. He gives humanity exactly what they have demonstrated they are after. He gives them the chaos that they have an appetite for, demonstrated by their depravity. The text says every intent of the thoughts of their hearts was only evil continually. Every intent was only evil continually. And because the humans are royal priests representing creation before God, the creation suffers the consequence of their depravity. The sentiment is echoed in Romans 8:19, which says, "For the creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed." For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning, as in the pains of childbirth, right up to the present time. Not only so, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption to sonship, the redemption of our bodies. The flood happens. It rains for 40 days and 40 nights, and creation is wiped out. And when the rain ceases, what do the biblical authors want us to see? God takes this decreation moment and he begins to reverse it. The first thing we hear is that the waters retract from the land and the mountains come clear and the vegetation returns, and God opens the door of the ark and he lets humanity back upon the planet. He then continues and he makes a covenant with Noah. God blesses Noah and his sons according to Genesis 9:9, saying to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth." This should remind us of the creation story when God blessed Adam and Eve and told them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. It continues to say in verse 2, "The fear and the dread of you will fall on the beasts of the earth and all the birds in the sky, on every creature that moves along the ground and all the fish in the sea. They are given into your hands." Noah and his family are given dominion, much like Adam and Eve were given dominion over all the creatures. Except this time, God, realizing that he's working with a brokenness in a broken creation, we see in verse 3 the following: "Everything that lives and moves about will be food for you. Just as I gave you the green plants, I now give you everything." For the first time, we see that humanity is given permission to take life and eat the flesh of created creatures. God makes a caveat though, and he says, "But you must not eat meat that has its lifeblood still in it. What is God saying here? God is saying, do not eat the animal whilst it's still alive. Verse 5, and for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal, and from each human being too, I will demand an accounting for the life of another human being. Whoever sheds human blood, by humans shall their blood be shed, for in the image of God has God made mankind. Even though God is starting again, the reality is that this world is still fallen. And that because this world in this fall, because this world is fallen, we will find those who are image bearers taking the life of other image bearers. We will also find where man was given dominion over creatures, that these creatures too will try and take the life of the image bearers. This, family, is unthinkable and beyond the scope of the imagination in Eden. This is not what God intended. But then we see the following, that God makes a covenant with Noah, and not only does he make a covenant with Noah, he makes a cosmic covenant in that he covenants with the whole earth that never again will he bring a flood to destroy the earth. God chooses not to abandon humanity to their folly and decay. Instead, what he does is that he initiates a rescue mission. His rescue mission is ultimately to get the people of God back to the place of God, in the presence of God. He does this through a series of rescues, which are found in the covenants that God makes with humans, with Abraham, with Moses, with David, till they find their climax in Jesus. With the covenant with Noah, found in Genesis 9, God re-establishes contact with the fallen world through Noah. And where there has been an earthly and a heavenly transgression, he makes a cosmic covenant sealed with a cosmic sign in the heavens. Now, in conclusion, I want to take us to a text in the New Testament where the flood narrative is referred to by Jesus. In Matthew 24, verses 37 to 39, Jesus talking about his second coming, that fast approaching epoch dividing event where life before and life after will be dramatically different because of the passing of the current heaven and earth and the coming of the new heaven and the new earth. Jesus says this, as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. This is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Jordan Peterson, a clinical psychologist, author, and professor, speaking in his biblical series, talking about the psychology of the flood, as it were, he says this, we live in a corrupt structure, and a part of that corruption is just happenstance. It's the way things fall apart. But the other part of it is that not only are we not aiming up, we're actually aiming down. And the flood story is a warning. It's a very clear warning, and the warning is if you aim down enough, and then if enough of you aim down enough at the same time, everything will degenerate into something that's indistinguishable from the chaos from which things emerged at the beginning of time. Jesus, when he returns, will be coming to fulfill God's rescue mission. The new covenant that Jesus calls us to is much like the ark that God commanded Noah to build to carry him through the chaotic waters. So, when Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and walked faithfully with God, I know that I'm not like Noah. But Jesus would say to me, Jesus would say to all of humanity, I am he who is righteous, who is blameless, and walks faithfully with God. I have an ark. This ark looks a lot more like a cross, but it can carry you over the chaotic waters. People assume that the world is generally a good place and that bad things are the irregular event that interfere with the overall goodness. But I want to put it to you that, like Jordan Peterson proposes to us, that we are in a broken structure with a culture that is aiming down, down away from God. We are a murderous group, to say the least. We may find ourselves in a version of pre-chaotic waters trying to navigate our way through. Noah would say to us, aim up, lean toward being righteous and blameless, walk with God. When the proverbial waters come, will the boat that you are in be sufficient to carry you through the chaos? When the proverbial waters come, will the direction you are aiming in mean a return to chaos and darkness for you outside of the place of God, with the people of God, in the presence of God? Are you in the ark that Jesus has provided through the cross? Let's pray. Oh, Father, we are humbled. We are humbled by your intentionality toward us. There are things that are far above us when it comes to your ways, but you clearly show that you are for us, that indeed you are on a rescue mission for the people of God to return to the place of God, to be with their God in the presence of God. I pray, God, that if there is anyone listening today who finds themselves outside of the ark, who finds themselves pointing downward, even as it pertains to the thoughts of their hearts and the intentions of their will, that Jesus, you are the ark. And that as we come into covenant with you, you promise that you will carry us over the chaotic waters. Thank you for your faithfulness. So if that is you today, I want you to know that as long as today is today, you can make the choice to jump into the ark that is Jesus providing a way for you over the chaotic waters. Find the link in the chat box below and just give your life to Jesus today, so that when the proverbial waters come, you will find yourself in the ark of God. Thank you so much for joining us for the word today. I trust that it was a good, deep time of exploring the word together. Now, as we end, I would love to bless you in this way. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord cause his face to shine upon you. May the Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. Now, and forevermore.